All right, our parasha study for today is the first part of Exodus. Shemot, as written up there. Jeff was so kind to start up my notes. I appreciate it. Other book here. This Exodus section, the first part, was introducing Exodus, obviously, coming in from chapter 1, traveling through the first verse of chapter 6. We get to see a great contrast between what happened in Genesis with the Pharaoh of Genesis and what happens with the Pharaohs of Exodus. So Exodus chapter 1. And these are the names of the children of Israel who are coming to Egypt. With Jacob, each man and his household came. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah. Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin. Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. And all the persons who emerged from Jacob's loins were 70 souls, and Joseph was in Egypt. Now Joseph died, and all his brothers, and that generation, and the entire generation. The children of Israel were fruitful, teemed, and increased, and became strong, very, very much so, and the land became filled with them. A new king arose over Egypt, who did not know of Joseph. He said to his people, "Behold, the people of the children of Israel are more numerous and stronger than we. Come, let us outsmart it, lest it become numerous, and it may be that if a war will occur, it too may join our enemies and wage war against us and go up from the land." So they appointed taskmasters over it in order to afflict it with their burdens. It built storage cities for Pharaoh, Pithom, and Ramses, but as much as they would afflict it, so it would increase. And so it would spread out. And they became disgusted because of the children of Israel. Egypt enslaved the children of Israel with crushing harshness. They embittered their lives with hard work, with mortar, with bricks, with every labor of the field. All their labors that they performed with them were with crushing harshness. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of the first was Sifra, and the name of the second was Puah. He said, "When you deliver the Hebrew women, and you see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, you are to kill him. If it is a daughter, she shall live." But the midwives feared God, and they did not do as the king of Egypt spoke to them, and they caused the boys to live. The king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this thing, that you have caused the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are unlike the Egyptian women, for they are experts. Before the midwife comes to them, they have given birth." God benefited the midwives, and the people increased and became very strong. And it was because the midwives feared God that he made them houses. Pharaoh commanded his entire people, saying, "Every son that will be born into the river shall you throw him, and every daughter you shall keep alive." Chapter 2. A man went in from the house of Levi and took a daughter of Levi. The woman conceived and gave birth to a son. She saw that he was good, and she hid him for 3 months. She could not hide him any longer, so she took for him a wicker basket and smeared it with clay and pitch. She placed the child into it and placed it among the reeds at the bank of the river. His sister stationed herself at a distance to know what would be done with him. Pharaoh's daughter went down to bathe by the river, and her maidens walked along the river. She saw the basket among the reeds, and she sent her maidservant, and she took it. She opened it and saw him, the child, and behold, a youth was crying. She took pity upon him, and said, "This is one of the Hebrew boys." His sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and summon for you a wet nurse from the Hebrew woman, who will nurse the baby for you?" The daughter of Pharaoh said, "Go." The girl went and summoned the boy's mother. Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this boy and nurse him for me, and I will give you your pay." So the woman took the boy and nursed him. The boy grew up, and she brought him to the daughter of Pharaoh, and he was a son to her. She called his name Moses, as she said, "For I drew him from the water." It happened in those days that Moses grew up and went out to his brethren and observed their burdens. And he saw an Egyptian man striking a Hebrew man of his brethren. He turned this way and saw that there was no man. So he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. He said to the one, "Why would you strike your fellow?" He replied, "Who appointed you as a dignitary, a ruler, and a judge over us? Do you propose to murder me as you murdered the Egyptian?" Moses was frightened. He thought, "Indeed, the matter is now known." Pharaoh heard about this matter and sought to kill Moses, so Moses fled from before Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian. He sat by a well. The minister of Midian had 7 daughters. They came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's sheep. The shepherds came and drove them away. Moses got up and saved them and watered their sheep. They came to El, their father. He said, "How could you come so quickly today?" They replied, "An Egyptian man saved us from the shepherds, and he even drew water for us and watered the sheep." He said to his daughters, "Then where is he? Why did you leave the man? Summon him and let him eat bread." Moses desired to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moses. She gave birth to a son. He named him Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." During those many days, it happened the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel groaned because of the work, and they cried out. Their outcry, because of the work, they went up to God. God heard their moaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. God saw the children of Israel, and God knew. Chapter 3. Moses was shepherding the sheep of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian. He guided the sheep far in the wilderness, and he arrived at the mountain of God toward Horeb. An angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blaze of fire from amid the bush. He saw, behold, the bush was burning in the fire, but the bush was not consumed. Moses thought, "I will turn aside now and look at this great sight. Why will the bush not be burned?" The Lord saw that he turned aside to see, and God called out to him from amid the bush and said, "Moses, Moses." He replied, "Here I am." He said, "Do not come closer to here. Remove your shoes from your feet. The place upon which you stand is holy ground." And he said, "I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob." Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to gaze toward God. The Lord said, "I have indeed seen the affliction of my people that is in Egypt, and I have heard its outcry because of its taskmasters. For I have known of its sufferings. I shall descend to rescue it from the hand of Egypt, and to bring it up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite. Now, behold, the outcry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. And now go, and I shall dispatch you to Pharaoh, and you shall take my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt." Moses replied to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, that I should take the children of Israel out of Egypt?" And he said, "For I shall be with you, and this is your sign that I have sent you. When you take the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain." Moses said to God, "Behold, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your forefathers has sent me to you,' and they say to me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" The Lord answered Moses, "I shall be as I shall be." He said, "So shall you say to the children of Israel, 'I shall be has sent me to you.'" God said further to Moses, "So shall you say the children of Israel, 'The Lord, the God of your forefathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob, has dispatched me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my remembrance from generation to generation. Go and gather the elders of Israel and say to them, 'The Lord, the God of your forefathers, has appeared to me, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, saying, I have surely remembered you and what is done to you in Egypt. And I have said, I shall bring you up from the affliction of Egypt to the land of the Canaanite, the Hittite, the Amorite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, to land flowing with milk and honey. They will heed your voice. You and the elders of Israel shall come to the king of Egypt and say to him, 'The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, happened upon us, and now, please, let us go on a 3-day journey in the wilderness, and we shall bring offerings, Lord our God. I know the king of Egypt will not allow you to go, except through a strong hand. I shall stretch out my hand, and I shall strike Egypt with all my wonders, and that I shall perform in its midst. And after that, he will send you out. I shall grant this people favor in the eyes of Egypt, that will happen when you go out, you will not go empty-handed. Each woman shall request from her neighbor and from the one who lives in her house silver vessels, golden vessels, and garments. You shall put them on your sons and daughters, and you shall empty out Egypt. Chapter 4. Moses responded and said, But they will not believe me, and they will not heed my voice. For they will say, The Lord did not appear to you. The Lord said to him, What is that in your hand? He said, A staff. He said, Cast it on the ground. And he cast it on the ground and became a snake. Moses fled from it. The Lord said to Moses, Stretch out your hand, grasp its tail. He stretched out his hand and grasped it tightly, and became a staff in his palm. So they shall believe the Lord, the God of their forefathers, appeared to you, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. The Lord said further to him, Bring your hand into your bosom. And he brought his hand to his bosom, and then he withdrew it, and behold, his hand was leprous like snow. He said, Return your hand to your bosom. And he returned his hand to his bosom, and then he removed it from his bosom, and behold, it reverted to be like his flesh. It shall be that if they do not believe you, and do not heed the voice of the first sign, they will believe the voice of the latter sign. And it shall be that if they do not believe even these two signs, and do not heed your voice, you shall take the water of the river, and pour it out on dry land. The water that you shall take the river will become blood when it is on the dry land. Moses replied to the Lord, Please, my Lord, I am not a man of words, not since yesterday, nor since the day before yesterday, nor since you first spoke to your servant, for I am heavy of mouth and heavy of speech. The Lord said to him, Who makes a mouth for a man? Or who makes the one dumb or deaf? Or sighted or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? Now go. I shall be with your mouth and teach you what you should say. He replied, Please, my Lord, send through whomever you will send. The wrath of the Lord burned against Moses and said, Is there not Aaron, your brother, the Levite? I know that he shall surely speak. Moreover, behold, he is going out to meet you. When he sees you, he will rejoice in his heart. You shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I shall be with your mouth and with his mouth, and teach you both what you are to do. He shall speak for you to the people, and it will be that he will be your mouth, and you will be his God. And his staff you shall take in your hand, with which you shall perform the signs. So Moses went and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, Let me go now back to my brethren who are in Egypt, and see if they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, Go in peace. The Lord said to Moses in Midian, Go, return to Egypt, for all the people who seek your life have died. So Moses took his wife, his sons, mounted them on the donkey, and returned to the land of Egypt. And Moses took the staff of God in his hand. The Lord said to Moses, When you go to return to Egypt, see all the wonders that I have put in your hand and perform them before Pharaoh. But I shall strengthen his heart, and he will not send out the people. You shall say to Pharaoh, So said the Lord, My firstborn son is Israel. So I say to you, Send out my son, that he may serve me. But if you have refused to send him out, behold, I shall kill your firstborn son. It was on the way in the lodging that the Lord encountered him and sought to kill him. So Zipporah took a sharp stone and cut off the foreskin of her son and touched it to his feet and said, You caused my bridegroom's bloodshed. So he released him, and then she said, A bridegroom's bloodshed was because of circumcision. The Lord said to Aaron, Go meet Moses to the wilderness. So when he encountered him at the mountain of God, and he kissed him. Moses related to Aaron all the words of the Lord that he dispatched to him, and all the signs that he had commanded him. Moses and Aaron went and gathered all the elders of the children of Israel. Aaron spoke all the words the Lord had spoken to Moses, and he performed the signs in the sight of the people. People believed, and they heard that the Lord had remembered the children of Israel, and he saw their affliction. They bowed their heads and prostrated themselves. Chapter 5. Afterwards, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, "So said the Lord, the God of Israel, send out my people that they may celebrate for me in the wilderness." Pharaoh replied, "Who is the Lord that I should heed his voice to send out Israel? I do not know the Lord, nor will I send out Israel." So they said, "The Lord, the God of the Hebrews, happened upon us. Let us now go for a 3-day journey in the wilderness. We shall bring offerings to the Lord our God, lest he strike us dead with the plague or with the sword." The king of Egypt said to them, "Moses and Aaron, why do you disturb the people from its work? Go to your own burdens." And Pharaoh said, "Behold, the people of the land are now numerous, and you would have them cease from their burdens." On that day, Pharaoh ordered the taskmasters over the people and its foremen, saying, "You shall no longer give straw to the people to manufacture their bricks as yesterday and before yesterday. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks that they were making yesterday and before yesterday you shall impose upon them. Do not reduce it. For they are lazy. Therefore they cry out, saying, 'Let us go and bring offerings to our God.' Let the work be heavier upon the men, and let them engage in it, and let them not pay attention to false words." The taskmaster of the people and its foreman went out and spoke to the people, saying, "So said Pharaoh, I am not giving you straw. Go yourselves and take yourselves straw from whatever you find, for nothing will be reduced from your work." So the people spread out throughout the entire land of Egypt to gather gleanings for straw. The taskmasters pressed them, saying, "Complete your work, the daily matter, each day, as when there was straw." The former of the children of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had appointed over them, were beaten, saying, "Why did you not complete your requirement to make bricks, as yesterday, before yesterday, even yesterday, and even today?" The former of the children of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, "Why do you do this to your servants? Straw is not given to your servants, yet they tell us, 'Make bricks.' Behold, your servants are being beaten, and it is a sin for your own people." He said, "You are lazy, lazy. Therefore you say, 'Let us go and bring offerings to the Lord.' Now go to work. Straw will not be given to you, but you must provide the quota of bricks." The former of the children of Israel saw themselves in great distress when he said, "They do not reduce your bricks, the daily matter each day." They encountered Moses and Aaron standing to meet them. As they left Pharaoh's presence, they said to them, "May the Lord look upon you and judge, for you have made our very scent abhorrent in the eyes of Pharaoh and the eyes of his servants, to place a sword in their hands to murder us." Moses returned to the Lord and said, "My Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why have you sent me? From the time I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he did evil to this people, but you did not rescue your people." Chapter 6. The Lord said to Moses, "Now you will see what I shall do to Pharaoh, for through a strong hand he will send them out, and with a strong hand he will drive them from his land." That is the first section of Genesis. Shemot, the names. Exodus. Any questions or comments before I go into this? Obviously, we have a very great change from the Pharaoh of Genesis to Pharaoh of Exodus. Yes, Jeff.
Well, the one thing I learned in this is that now I know why they had to cleanse the land, because it was full of parasites.
Yeah. That's just, oh well. I won't go there.
You're not going to go there?
Yeah. Go ahead, Michelle, your comment. Oh, did you have a comment? Sorry, yeah, go ahead. Mm. Oh, sorry, you talked to her. That's all right. Yeah. Any other comments other than the parasite mentioning? See, I think there's a weird reason for wormwood, right? All right, well, excuse me. This section, obviously, it's covering clearly a good chunk of details regarding leading up through Moses' early life and into his first encounter with Pharaoh. We saw at the end of Genesis and the symbols and what was happening and how the men came in from Jacob and all his household, and Pharaoh greeted them well with great, you know, fanfare, essentially, how he brought them with carts and wagons. That Pharaoh clearly treated Egypt and treated Israel and Joseph in particular far different than this one does. Now, this one shows up in the scene. We do not know biologically or the exact for certainty which Pharaoh this is. Commonly saying, oh, what's the Pharaoh of Ramses, right? That's the traditional identification. Probably not. But it's common to cite him because he was one of the most famous pharaohs of Egypt. Much like how we've used that term a couple of times. And the Bible does it a couple of times with Isaiah. Uses someone who is most prominent to identify some particular phrase or detail. This Pharaoh, we don't know what his name was. We don't know which one it was. Most likely is a Pharaoh that's ruling about 1500 or so BC. Roughly that time period. And that is based on the death of Jacob, how old he was when he died, and what Solomon said when he built the temple, as far as how many years it had been since they exited Egypt. That Pharaoh, at that time period, 1500 BC, and then subsequent ones, corresponds to King Tutmosis the First, which kind of makes sense because Tutmosis and Moses. There's probably logical reason as to why or how Moses got his name, because the daughter of the Pharaoh named him. She probably named him after her dad. King Tutmosis the First was not born of the pharaohs. He was not royal line at all. He was a commoner. He was born as an ordinary Egyptian citizen. He came to power through great strength because he became a military commander of the pharaohs of Egypt. And then he killed the pharaoh of Egypt and took his place. So it kind of makes sense. It could be the same guy that's at the time period. Now, it's approximate. No one can prove it. You have evidence that Moses and him knew each other or had any correlations. It kind of makes sense in the time period according to what Solomon says, as far as he's within about 3 years of when that guy comes to power. So it kind of makes sense. It could be. But Tutmosis the First, he was started the 18th Egyptian dynasty. So I couldn't name all the dynasties. Don't really care where they all are. Oh, yes, go ahead.
Well, see, it could also make sense because like his big threat was them going to war with Israelites.
Right,
well.
Exactly. He's fearful of them, the Hittite Empire. And Tutmosis the First, his only real, you say, claim to fame is his military power when he took the Pharaoh's position. He headed south and took over, you know, basically a lot of territory down south of the Egyptian territory and took over swaths of land. But he died early on. He became to power really late in life. He was only power for about 6 years. And then he passes on and his then subsequent sons continue on for a few more generations before they're wiped out by the next new pharaoh. Kind of like the Greek empires and the Roman empires. They come and they go. No very big use for them. So probably that time period, can't say for certain, but it does make some sense. I want to bring your attention to his, as James pointed out, his reasoning, this first pharaoh. So go to Exodus chapter 1, the beginning of our little reading cycle. Mind you, this event, or this time period, these events that's happening, recorded in Exodus, are not that far removed from the events in Egypt, or sorry, from Genesis, from what happened before. As it points out very clearly in the first few verses, it says, these are the names of children who came from Egypt. Moses rattles off the sons of, you know, there's obviously Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, Benjamin, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. Does not rattle off, as does Joseph too, does not rattle off all of their children. So he points out in the first section here that these are the men, Joseph and all his brothers died of that entire generation. So all those sons, all those men died. The children, of course, were fruitful, they teemed, became very strong, and a new king arose over Egypt. Traditionally speaking, which is incorrect, is the belief that the children of Israel were in Egypt for 400 years, and then after 400 years, or 430 years, depending on how you, where you're going to read it, they get to leave Egypt. That is not correct. That is poor mathematics. The 400-year philosophy came from the promise given to Abraham that God said they'd be in Egypt for 400 years. Well, according to Solomon, and according to the times of the patriarchs, they are in actual the land of Egypt for about 210 years. That's how much time they're actually in there. They come out about 400 years after God told Abraham it would be 400 years. So if you have a timeline, this is a very basic timeline, I'm artificially starting it. Zero is the point which God talks to Abraham. That's time zero. 400 years later, or 430, depending on who you're reading, they come out. So it's Exodus. That's 400 years go by. Well, from Abraham to Exodus is 400 years, or 430, depending on who you're looking at. They weren't in Exodus or Egypt at the time of Abraham. They weren't there yet. Now, they don't go there until, you know, Abraham lives, he dies, Isaac lives, he dies, Jacob lives and almost dies before he gets in there. So they go there many years later. Roughly 190 years go by before Jacob goes in to Egypt. And then you got about 210 years from Jacob entering Egypt to them coming out of Egypt. Now, in the next chapter, chapter 6, which Jeff will cover next week, it discusses the ages of how old some of these men were, when they died, this, how they lived this long, this lived that long, such and such. And that gives you, narrows it down very clearly, that they are actually enslaved at no more than at that point, which means the sons of Jacob have to die off, so the Levi and Simeon and Judah, they all die off before the enslavement happens. Some of the men who get enslaved were alive when they came into Egypt with Jacob. They were old men. Some of them were still alive. Their children, the ones that came out, and their grandchildren, the ones who came out. So these men, you know, Levi has three sons, right? There's Korah, there's Merari, and what's the third one? There's a G. I forgot. Anyway, Gershom? No, okay, Gershom. Well, whatever his name is, I forgot. There's a third one too. He has three sons. One of them dies in Egypt. What do the two do? They come out with the Exodus. Over here with Moses. So these men aren't all dead. They don't all perish. And some of these men knew who Joseph was when the enslavement happens. So they're only enslaved at most about 116 years or so, give or take. That's the time of enslavement. So Moses died probably not knowing Levi, but Moses' mom was Levi's daughter. Does that make sense? Moses' mother was Jochebed, Levi's daughter, biological daughter. Not his granddaughter, not his great, his daughter. So Moses' mom knew her dad, Levi. And Moses, obviously, knew his biological mother, Jochebed. So it's not like this is hundreds of years elapsed and no one knows who anybody was. This is not that far removed. This is a short period of time happens between the memory of Pharaoh with Joseph, which shows up is around this point with Joseph, bringing his family in. This Pharaoh knew him, and it's only, you know, less than 100 years go by before the new Pharaohs have no knowledge, have no care, no understanding who Joseph was. So it brings up the obvious point. There's a pretty good chance this is a new Pharaoh, meaning new family line, having no recollection or care or history of what happened before. That's most likely what's going on, which kind of makes sense of what's happening with this new Pharaoh on the scene. It doesn't necessarily mean a new, just like the next generation, it most likely means a completely new dynasty has started. A new pharaohs have shown up. Because it's not far removed time-wise. And even Moses's Aaron's nephews, They're the ones that bring Aaron's two sons out. They're the sons of his uncle. It's his uncle, and the uncle is the son of Levi. So these are not, you know, crazy far distances of generations. They are years go by, but the people still know each other. I want to point that out to us, that Jochebed knew her dad, and she, of course, is Moses' mom, and Aaron's mom, and Miriam's mom. So it's the first generation who dies. And, of course, they all come up, and the king of Egypt shows up, and this new guys show up. Let's see. Jump to Pharaoh's reasoning. Chapter 1. This is verse 9 and 10. He said to his people, "Behold, the pillars of Israel are more numerous and stronger than we are. Come, let us outsmart, lest it become numerous, and they may be at war." "It may be that if a war will occur too, they may join our enemies and wage war against us and go up from the land." So what's he afraid of?
Afraid of them starting a war with
him. He is afraid of them joining a war. And note, Egypt and, well, the northern tribe, which is like the Syrian Hittite Empire, were pretty much didn't like each other. They were ruling back and forth. I'm going to erase this. I don't need it anymore. This little timeline. He's afraid of losing. But they weren't slaves yet. He's just afraid they were Israelites still. They weren't slaves. They're still free in the land of Goshen. So what's he afraid of? And that would imply that he's a very small contingent if there's more of them than us, because there aren't that many people than yet. they're still pretty small groups. He's more of them than us. He's lost of the people. He doesn't want to lose them. Now, of course, this is where you get your first dilemma and the first citation of in Judaism, the first anti-Semite. and there's a reason why they said it. It's not because they're anti-Semitic per se. It's the thought process. See, anti-Semitism does not necessarily mean against somebody who's Semitic. That's not what the actual, that's what the word means, not what the concept means. The concept means is what's written right here. "Least being more numerous than us, and join our enemies, wage war and go up from the land. They're too dangerous to keep, but too valuable to get rid of." That's your element of anti-Semitism. It's not the anti-race. Who cares? Race doesn't mean anything. Anti-black, anti-white, who cares? It's when you're dealing with a group of people that are too dangerous to keep, but too valuable to throw away. And your solution? Destroy or enslave. That is the concept, that is the base, the foundation of all anti-Semitic belief systems and how it is used. That's where you got the Nazis from, that's where you got the communist Russian from. A lot of groups, even the communist, capitalism today, it's the same principle. It doesn't matter who the group is. It can be a group, Joe Schmooley number, yellow. It doesn't matter. It's the concept, you're too dangerous to me to keep you. But you're too valuable for me to get rid of you. Yes, Cheryl.
What dawned on me was how there's a lot of the Hebrews and a little of the Mizraims. Wouldn't him enslaving the Hebrews cause the very revolt that he was trying to prevent?
Which is what it wound up doing, essentially. It wound up causing the revolt. Which, that's where the dangerous part comes from. Why would they allow the enslavement to cause the revolt, or why would they allow a revolt? First of all, getting into the mind of a person, I can't do that. I'm sorry, so I can't answer the question for you. But I can tell you this much: in general, a people like to be where they are. You ever hear that? Stuck in a rut? Yeah, I am. We don't like to have to change. We like what we're doing. Don't make me change. So when change comes upon you, it's much like a frog with the whole hot. You throw them in hot water, they jump out. You put cold water, turn the burner on, and they stay there until they die. They're fine. So it's the subtle changes that make it. In the case of how Pharaoh went about this process, do not envision that this happened in one day. The enslavement was not an instantaneous, now we're all enslaved, now let's kill the babies, let's... No, this was a process time period. Yes, Tammy.
Yeah, we were talking about this at the table last night with Jeff's dad, is... You know, we're just looking at the genealogy and all that. I've been researching on his family, and we're looking mostly at his family, but even my family, is that the folks that came to the United States, most of them, if you look at the history and the timeline when they came, they didn't come for happy reasons. Many of them, particularly in Jeff's family, they fled war, persecution. They were fleeing things like forcible conscription into the army, these kind of things. You don't usually leave a place that's perfectly comfortable and happy. You leave a place that
it's
is
hard.
Seeking to enslave you in the army or seeking to forcibly convert you to their, like my family,
life.
They felt they left Ukraine because the Russians were wanting to make the Germans into Russians. They were forcibly going to force them to become Russian. And they didn't want to be Russian. And they fled. So you don't flee where people are treating you well and you're comfortable and you're happy. You flee because... someone's trying to force something
it's
on
hard.
You don't want to do.
It's hard. Exactly. That's absolutely true. So in this process, the people, when it starts out here, which I have other books that word this differently, but I didn't read their section of it. I mean, I didn't read out loud to you. The philosophy was here when he appointed taskmasters over them and such. This is considered a form of labor tax. The enslavement they started out was more of a labor tax. As far as, all right, you live here, you had the land of Goshen, you have a duty to go back and, you know, help your countrymen type of thing. Let's help it. Let's for this free land you have, this great land you have, we're going to tax you on this effort, this great thing you've had. That is a common way of looking at this, not the only way. A look at what Pharaoh was doing, a style of labor tax, of how you something start something. That's how you get a mass group of people to enslave themselves, is by incremental amounts, not instantaneous, him would hit you with everything. So however long this process took was probably more than 1 year and probably less than a generation. So the time slot is in there. How long, I don't know for certain, but most likely you started out as a labor tax. Beza points out they built cities for him. Well, the cities of basically storage cities. They were used for military reasons. But it would have gone from there to talking to midwives, subversively trying to kill the children. That didn't work. And then he more overtly does so and commands his army, his soldiers to go out, seek out, and execute the boys. Of certain ages, because obviously Aaron, Moses' older brother, was not killed. So it's of an age group that they were assigned to go kill boys, because Aaron was not included. He was only a few years older than Moses. So he was of Moses' age of, wasn't born yet, when the decree went out, and yet Aaron is still alive, and he's probably one of the sons of that the midwives didn't kill. Who knows? but that's what was going on in that time period. So it's an incremental process, like I said before. If this is the same time, Moses the first, he only lives there for 6 years, so it could have, or in rulership for 6 years, it could have been a six-year time period before God wiped him out, which would be fitting, because God did the same thing to Herod, which we'll talk about that later. Let's continue on. So, obviously, the midwives, Pharaoh calls the midwives and tries to do an infanticide process of killing them off, right? What do the midwives do? So we know what the Pharaoh's goal is, to not lose the people, but not be afraid of them, to oppress or control them without losing them. So that's his goal. Don't lose the people, but still be full control of them. And he believed killing the sons would take care of that problem, which kind of makes sense. The military most likely be sons. They look like the ones to resist. So he tells the midwives, all right, give her the boys. He only calls two. I don't know how many midwives Israel had at the time. Could have been just two. Could have been 1,000. I don't really know. It doesn't matter. But he calls up two, and they are the ones which he, of course, respond. Essentially, they lie to him, to the Pharaoh, for lack of a better term. They tell him what isn't true. Because the Hebrew women in verse 19 are unlike Egyptian women, for they are experts, or they are stronger. Before the midwife comes to them, they have given birth. Now, God blesses them in verse 20 and discusses that he benefited the midwives in two ways. God blessed them. The first way, the people increased, became very strong. What is a midwife's job?
Deliver
babies of a group or a group of people or family, whoever it is. And if you do a good job, you deliver more babies, right? And if you do a really good job, those babies grow up, right? and they have their own children. So if you do a really good job, you have a lot of live births. You're a successful midwife. Good job. That's a blessing. So God blessed them in their work. He also blessed them with families of their own, out of their own household. So God gave them two blessings. They got to see the successfulness of their work. I don't know how old these ladies were, but then later on, he gives them, or at some point in time, he gives them their own households. They become their own mothers and such. Because it was the midwives who feared God, in verse 21, that he gave them their own houses. Now Pharaoh went from the more subversive route, the more overt route. Commanded his entire people, saying, every son that will be born in the river you shall throw him, every daughter you shall keep alive. Now everybody knows. The decree has gone out. So, what's his name? Amram. That's his name. Moses' dad's name is Amram. So the man, or Amram is actually, the house of Levi, Levi's grandson. He took a daughter of Levi, which is his aunt, to a daughter of Levi, and the woman conceived and gave birth to a son. She thought he was good. She hid him for 3 months. So Moses' dad is Amram, his mom is Jochebed, which is recorded in chapter 6. She, of course, is Levi's daughter, and Amram is Levi's grandson. So they are the ones give birth or deal with this child who shows up. They can't hide him for very long. She saw it was a good child, was obviously for whatever reason that was valuable. I'm going to go discuss that just a little bit, the whatever reason. Do the people know the blessing that God told Abraham about the 400 years of Egypt? I would think they would. Think about who these people are. All right? So God promised Abraham it would be 400 years. But more specifically, in the fourth generation, they would come out. That's what God specifically told Abraham back in Genesis. Just 15. So discuss this. 400 years, but the fourth generation, I assume the people can count to at least the number four. They can at least count to number four. I assume they all count to number four. So the fourth generation is what generation? Moses's and Aaron's. It's that generation is number four. As far as how you would account it. So they know this generation has to come out. They know this is the rule. Joseph told them, when you're going to come out, surely God will deliver you out of here. Bring my bones with you. They knew what Joseph instructed them. They knew what Jacob instructed them. So they have a basic memory of what they were taught by the patriarchs. I don't know how much they knew, but they probably knew this much to say there's something about this generation that's being killed. That's the important one. Which should sound familiar to you with Herod and what he did with his time period. So they know that there is some value in this generation. Which child, they don't know. But the mother, Jochebed, who is Levi's daughter, who, since Levi dies after Joseph, she probably knew Joseph. Joseph was younger. Probably knew Joseph too. Probably even met him. Possibly even met him. Who knows? I don't know how busy the guy was at old age. But they would have known some information. Of course, she gets to nurse Moses too. She probably taught him some stuff too while he was young. So it's this generation they're interested in. So all of Israel knows there's something about this fourth generation that's important. So there is a usefulness to this. They do have some knowledge of this. Presumably the pharaohs have no knowledge of it, but at least they probably do. So she hid him for 3 months, could not no longer. She obviously brings him to the riverbanks and his sister Miriam watches over. I don't know whether they knew Pharaoh's daughter was coming down from bathing or not. I don't really care. Either way, Pharaoh's daughter comes and sees Moses and draws him out. And of course, Jochebed gets to nurse him with Miriam's quick thinking and calling and showing up. Let's see. Let's jump forward here. She names him. What's she name him? She named him Moses, for she drew him out. The Egyptian word for that isn't Moses. That's Monois. M-O-N-I-O-S is how we would spell it today. Moses is the Hebrew translation of it into it. So it doesn't really matter, but that's what it would have called. So he would not have known the term Moses. until, or maybe he may have known it from his mom, I'm not sure, but he would have been called by the Pharaoh's daughter by a slightly different name. It doesn't really matter. He pulls him out of the water. I'm willing to bet, based on verse 11 of chapter 2, that Moses probably knew of this fourth generation rule. Because he went out to observe what his people were like, what's happening to them, what their existence was. He knew about the slavery. He knew how hard it was. He went to go observe. And what was his instinctive reaction? Leader, boss, go kill the person who's oppressing a Hebrew slave. So he goes out there and he kills the Egyptian. He strikes the Egyptian to hide him in the sand, as long as no one was looking. So Moses has the idea of saving his people. He was going to know. He believed he was to lead them out. It was always some value there. I don't recall scripture saying he knew at this point in time. He learned later he had to. But he believed he was to lead them out, most likely because he would have known or have been taught or heard of that fourth generation was supposed to come out. Yes. Breastfeeding.
How long did they nurse their children in that?
I can't say for certain. I would be just because Isaac was nursed until he was two. I would guess at least until he's two, but may have been longer. I don't know. They do remember stories, but Moses also would have always known he was different. Number one, he's circumcised. Number two, the Egyptians don't eat with Hebrews. So if they're not going to eat with Hebrews, who gets to eat with Moses? The slaves. Or by himself. So either way, Moses growing up in Pharaoh's household knew he was distinctly different from everybody else. No offense to all the various movie makers that think otherwise. They make movies, make money off of it. But he would have known he was distinctly separate. He would have been isolated or separated out throughout his life, or at least for most of his life, growing up. Now, I don't know how old he was when he decided to go off and kill the Egyptian. Tradition says he's 40. Some of all studies, 20. I don't know how old he was. Either way, he was at the point where he's going to go save them and go conquer or take care of them and deliver his people. So he knew he was separate. If he knew he was separate, he probably knew some stories and some information that the pharaohs were not interested in. So, of course, he goes out the next day, of course, to see again what's going on. He sees two men fighting. And, of course, they're fighting. He goes after one and they says, well, you killed me, this Egyptian. So Moses then finds out or realizes that word has spread out. I can only speculate that the Hebrews were the ones who spread the word that Moses killed the Egyptian. And that the word traveled, and it traveled from there all the way back to the Egyptians. How it got there, I don't know. I'm not part of it. Wasn't there. But somehow the people didn't keep their mouth shut when they probably should have. So he tries to go save them. It backfires. Pharaoh finds out. Moses runs. So the saving people, as far as Moses is concerned, didn't happen. Wasn't going to be me. I'm done. I run away. So he doesn't believe or perceive he is now the one to deliver Israel, because his first attempt doing it his own way failed. I like the way it is because it says it failed, but it really didn't fail. He just thinks it did because it is how God designed it to be. Let's continue on here. Where is it? Wait. So it goes off to Midian. Now, I didn't put my map up here, did I? I'm going to get my map out for where Midian is relative to Egypt. This map's terrible. It doesn't do any good job. Anyway, I'll just draw a rough sketch of where Midian is relative to Egypt. So we have a Sinai Peninsula down here. Here's the Mediterranean Sea. Little blip of Mount Carmel. Sea goes down there, and this all Africa. Delta Nile, or the delta's over here from the Nile River. Nile River scribbles around. I don't remember where all the different cities are in Egypt. Some of you probably remember that. I don't remember all. Doesn't matter. Most of Egypt is dominated before Tutmosis I in this small strip of land. Not where modern-day Egypt borders would be, you know, way out here. A little massive triangle, modern-day Egyptian borders, right? So Egypt today is huge. At the time of the Pharaohs, it wasn't that big. Now, the sphere of influence was enormous, but the rulership was not. Thutmose I, his claim to fame, he expanded Egypt's territory all the way down. Right, by just ruling over. It was a military campaign. He was the most successful military ruler. He came back in a boat. Thutmose I, in a boat, after he conquered this territory, he brought his ships back and he took the king's son of, I forgot the name of the country, it was Nubia, that was it, Nubia, thank you. The king, no, Thutmose. That was his name. The pharaoh's name. Most likely, Thutmose the first. Yes, Carrie?
I just thought you were getting the names mixed up. So it was actually Moses?
Thutmose the first was the pharaoh of Egypt. Most likely the right pharaoh of Egypt. There's Thutmose the first, second, third, fourth. I think he dies, but the fifth one shows up. But that, before that dynasty wipes out. Anyway, he comes forward. Thutmose the first is known for his military campaign to Nubia and comes back with, he's really gross, mind you, with the son of the king of Nubia tied to the boat of his ship, dragging in the water, just parading him around. So he's known for his military campaign. So he comes out, this is the Red Sea. I use blue, forgive me. It's supposed to be the Red Sea. My marker is color blue. Midian is over here. Saudi Arabia era territory. The south tip of Jordan, which it would include the south, if modern day Jordan, if I drew all of Israel, so he's a little Dead Sea, Sea of Galilee's up, well, I didn't do a very good job in drawing this, a little closer this direction. Dead Sea, Galilee is actually up there, just about this little dot there. And that's where modern day Israel is, roughly. Jordan is, you know, out in this territory. Midian takes the southern tip of Jordan, the southern, actually, some of the quarter or so, down through along the coastline of the other side of the Red Sea, where we what is modern-day Saudi Arabia rules. That's where Midian's at. My map is not very spectacularly great here. So when Moses flees, where does he go? It says to Midian. That's pretty far away, isn't it? He takes off from this territory, travels most likely land route, all the way over to here, to Midian. Most likely because Midian was outside the sphere of influence of Egypt. Because it's on the other side of this river. Now, I would say outside isn't quite accurate because it did have ship trading back and forth. But the land routes didn't go there. The land routes bypassed Midian and went straight north through the Hittite Empire. So all land routes, they really didn't go to Midian. Midian was kind of left on its own to do your own thing. Well, that's where Moses thought was a good safe place outside of Pharaoh's rulership. Ishmaelites bought him, I believe the Midianites were, I remember, the Midianites, I can't remember, who they, do you recall who they sold him to? Well, they were together, right? Yeah, they passed off. So it was a buy sale, a buy trade. They were all engaged in the process. So the Midianites land route would have traveled from here trading to Egypt. They still didn't be part of that, but they were not part of the main trade routes. They had their own entity over here. So Jethro shows up. He's of course into that part of territory, that part of life in that region. So Moses goes there, he flees to a well. I don't know which well it is. It's somewhere in this region, obviously, near or not too far from Mount Horeb, I'm guessing, but that's just a guess. Jethro shows up, Jethro's daughters show up to the well, and of course, Moses saves them. They're obviously shepherdesses, not shepherds, so the shepherds were ruling that well the daughters were showing up at. And clearly the shepherds had no fear of the Midianite priest because he had no power there, obviously. They didn't fear him. So you have the shepherd showing up. Moses goes and saves him. Jethro, well. By the way, he goes by many, many names. Moses' father-in-law goes by many different names. There's Jethro. There's Reuel. There's Jether. And once what those, depending on how you word it, as far as who is what on the prepositions, it's Hobab. It's also a name for him. Hobab? Yes. And there's many different names he goes by. I think there's 7 total names he has, or that he's referenced to. I cannot answer why. I do know that there are purposes to some of them, because some of them are classified as titles as opposed to a name. But I can't tell you the names of all of them. I didn't research it. Maybe somebody else does, but it's not my thing to consider. Whatever reason, he was named many different names. Some have argued by the wording on in Book of Numbers 10, whether or not it was Reuel the man that Moses was talking to, or whether it was his son, but it depends on what the names all mean, as far as their purposes. Excuse me. Let's move on. I got something else I want to cover today, so I'm going to run through this a little faster. Let's see here. So he goes to Horeb, or Mount Horeb in chapter 3. Yay! Moses gets to find out what's going on and be part of God calling him back. Mountain of God in Horeb. Now, where the mountain is, there's been pictures online and such. You can search that yourself. I'm not going there today. Obviously, wherever it is, it's in Midian, which is the Arabian territory over here. That's where Moses is hanging out with his sheep. And he sees a burning bush. The bush obviously was not consumed. Now, if you notice, God chose a burning bush to talk to Moses. Why? And think of all the prophets God talks to. How many of them does he use some spectacular event to talk to them with? Very few. Very, very few. Most of us, they talked to him in a dream, or God spoke to so-and-so, or here's a message from God. There aren't a lot of big stories of, wow, here's a great burning bush, talk the burning bush, which everywhere's the burning bush, wow, because who forgets the burning bush? So all the reasons of how God communicates, he does it differently, but most of it's something unique, yes.
The Egyptians practiced magic like that.
They were a magic producer, or magic practicers, or however you want to argue it.
Maybe he saw that, maybe that's why God did that.
It's possible. It's possible that believing there was an Egyptian reference to it somehow, it's conceivable. My personal opinion is because God wanted us today to remember it. Remember it. All your kids, now me growing up as a child, how many times you say, son, daughter, whoever, God spoke to Moses, and what did he say? Oh, he said tons of stuff. I don't know. Which one are you talking about? He said, spoke to Moses over and over and over again. I just remember them all. And you say, son, daughter, when God was in a burning bush, what was going on? Oh, he's talking to Moses. He told him to go back to Egypt. Y'all remember that story? I'm sure you do. Who doesn't? God wanted this one remembered. He wanted it remembered importantly. So we'd all remember. Just like we remember the big fish with Jonah. Remember the fish, the burning bush with Moses. It's an important story. An important part of the story. God wanted this one never forgotten. So this communication style that God chose with Moses was designed to get your and my attention. So we wouldn't forget it. And even Jesus uses it again later. He used the same exact event. He doesn't cite the verse. He doesn't say, oh, well, in this chapter, God said, he just says, by the way, Moses, the bush, yeah. God said, well, we'll talk about that later. God said, was referencing something at that point in time. We'll talk about what he says in Matthew in a few minutes. But even Jesus remembers that, and everybody else remembers it. So we all remember that that's the story, Moses, the bush. Why? Why would God want us to remember this particular message, this particular event? To me, in my personal opinion, the reason is in verse 12 of chapter 3. He said, For I shall be with you. This is your sign that I have sent you. When you take the people out of Egypt, you will serve God on this mountain. To me, that's the reason God wanted this bush remembered. That you will be here. He says that's the sign. He didn't say the sign was, we'll lead them to a promised land of all this milk and honey. That's included, but that was not the specific reason God said. This would be the sign. This is the proof that I sent you. This is it. That you'll be here in this mountain. So if all of Israel gets to go to the mountain of God, So all of Israel gets to go to the mountain of God, it's not because all of Israel gets to go to the promised land. It's not because all of Israel could see all these great plagues and all these massive things happening in Egypt. It's not because God's going to do some great thing. He is, don't get me wrong. Some great thing against the Pharaoh of Egypt. It's that sign. That's the reason that God gave to me, in my opinion. Because this will be the proof, the evidence that I've sent you. There's the evidence that I am with you. The evidence that this is all according to what my will is this event. That you'll make it here, and all of us will make it here. That's the biggest thing. That's the message that he wanted to send out, in my opinion. Now, of course, the following... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I also think of that small burning bush.
Yes.
It's a down payment upon how that mountain will burn.
Yeah.
Much later.
Yes, very symbolic. God does not waste symbols, that's for sure. Yes, I do believe that that's the reason why he chose that sign. He could have used something else. He could have used, you know, some whatever. He's God. He didn't invent one. He wanted a burning bush, particularly a burning fire thing, in order to accentuate that. Because the burning massive fire, if those remember, when God burns a mountain, who gets to go up there and not die? Moses. Does fire kill you and me if I go into it? Yes. Did the fire kill Moses when he went into it? No. So Moses doesn't get consumed. So who's the tree? Moses. The righteousness is all based in trees, right? The tree represents Moses. The burning doesn't. It's the bush. The bush is Moses. Moses is the only one who gets to go up there and doesn't get consumed. He communicates back and forth to God. He is likened unto God. He even glows like God, what he's done. So Moses has this aura about him, literally aura. It's light, it's bright, don't look at it, about him. And he gets into this thing that everybody else, God even spells out loudly, don't let anyone touch the mountain. Just Moses gets to come up. So Moses gets to go in and not die. And everybody else, you, me, Bob Schmooley, would all die if we get to touch the mountain or get burned up. We don't get burned up. Moses, we would get burned up. Moses does not. Therefore, the bush represents Moses. Again, it's a symbol. Let's continue on, because there's more stuff in here. God's name. Moses asks, who I send you? What's your name? And he says, my name is, I shall be as I shall be. We've discussed this 100 times now, I think, over the years. It's abbreviation. I'm not going to go through all the details. Sorry, the abbreviation today is Yod-Heh Vav-Heh, or you would pronounce it however you wish to pronounce it. That's your business, not mine. The name is not so, let me write a word for it, is not as critical per se as its function. Most names, if you notice the Bible, have a function. For example, what was Moses' name? Moses. What was it named that? Because he drew out of the water. The name meant what happened to him or what he did. So in God's titles, he has lots of them, names mean something in what he did. They're associated to an action thing. Because most of Hebrew is built in action. So all of them are built in the same cycle, same process. excuse me. Let's see here. Yes. In verse 15, it points out, God the first, shall say, the Lord, the God of your forefathers, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has dispatched me to you. This is my name forever. Remembrance from generation to generation. Now Jesus pulls this on Luke chapter 20. We don't have to go there today. Well, might as well. I might take a heater break. It's getting kind of cold in here. Yeah. Yeah, you were complaining earlier about getting too hot. Now we're all getting too cold. I'll read this one section. We'll take a 10-minute break to turn the heater back on because it is a little chilly. Let's see here. Luke chapter 20. It is verse 27. There's a questioning about the resurrection. I'm going to have you guys think about this and we'll answer it when we come back from break. Verse 27 of Luke chapter 20. Some of the Sadducees who denied there was a resurrection came to him and asked him, saying, Teacher, Moses wrote to us that if a man's brother dies having a wife, he dies without children, his brother should take his wife and raise up offspring for his brother. Now there were seven brothers, and the first took a wife and died without children. The second took her as a wife, and he died childless. Then the third took her, and in like manner the seven all also, and they all left no children and died. The last of all, the woman died also. Therefore, In the resurrection, whose wife did she become? For all seven had her as wife. Jesus answered and said to them, the sons of this age marry and are given in marriage. Those who are counted worthy to attain that age and the resurrection from the dead neither marry nor are given in marriage. Nor can they die any more, for they are equal to the angels and are sons of God, being sons of the resurrection. Now, even Moses showed in the bush passage that the dead are raised when he called the Lord the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, God of Jacob. For he is not the God of dead, but the God of living. For all live to him. Now, Jesus believed or argued that this passage, this one statement, demonstrates there is a resurrection. One of the reasons, or what reason can you think of why Yeshua used this version, this passage, to identify that there is a resurrection, or that actually specify that Moses taught there was or is resurrection based on this passage? Any ideas? Any opinions? Yes, sure.
My only guess, and this is of course a guess, an uneducated one at that, is that those that look upon Elohim die, and he didn't. And so the fact that he came down alive, you know, shows that he has a resurrected body. I don't know.
Could be. That's a fair. It's a fair guess. I'm not going to argue with right or wrong or opinions, because this is an opinion as far as what Messiah was doing. I have my own. Well, I'll discuss it in a minute. Go ahead.
Well, in Ezekiel says, I am not interested in killing the dead. And the person who is righteous, that's the person that will live. Mm-hmm. So even if you go to sleep, you're alive. And even if you are alive, you can be a walking dead.
Yes. You can get a soulless person. Yes, you can. James, you have an idea? Go ahead.
It kind of struck an interesting tone with me when you read about the transfiguration on the mount, and both Elijah, who did ascend to heaven in life, but Moses is there with him, but it's claimed that Moses died. Mm-hmm. So
that's true. The transfiguration does cite that as an example, and we won't discuss that today, but that's true. It's a good example that you have characters that are showing up, they're long since dead, and note how on earth they recognize what Elijah and Moses looked like. I don't know. Some realize, hey, that looks, yeah, big name tag. That must be Moses' spirit, and that must be, I don't know how they got that. Because, I mean, portraits, I'm sure were not, I mean, little chiseling portraits, maybe the best they'd have gotten before. Somehow they figured out what he looked like and determined who they were looking at. I can't answer that one. But to me, the reason why I think and I believe when Messiah used this reference was, what was the reason or purpose that Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob obeyed God? What was there? What was in it for them? A promise? It was a promise, right? What was for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, what was their reasons, or what was their reason for obeying or believing God? What reason did God give them to make them want to obey or believe him? He gave them promises, very specific ones, of land, of prosperity, of generations, of kings and everybody else come from your loins, all this great stuff. All those men and their descendants, most of them, died without receiving any of it, right? Not a single one of them. Abraham didn't see it, Isaac didn't see it, Jacob started to see a glimpse of it as an old man, seeing his son Joseph being in so much power. But they all died, not receiving any of it. So, but God gave them a promise. So either God lied to them, and they weren't going to receive it because there's no resurrection according to Sadducees' belief, which would be what it meant. The Sadducees' belief that there's no resurrection, that these men died and didn't receive what God promised to them. If they didn't receive the promise, therefore there couldn't be resurrection in the Sadducees' belief system. Or they have to get resurrected in order for God to fulfill the promise that he gave to them originally. So, this citation to me, when I look at that and I see Messiah is using this as a citation, the God of the living, yeah, they have to be brought back in order to receive the promise God promised to them, else God is a liar. And God can't be a liar. So they have to be, he has to be God of the living. Whether they're living now or will be living again in the future makes no difference. He has to be their God, not those who are dead. So that's my reasoning as to why Messiah uses this phrase, this reading section, which actually, it cites it many times. The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is cited over and over and over again throughout the first few chapters of Exodus to identify who he was and what he was doing. That's the reason why it's given. That these promises have to be fulfilled to these men. Yes, Jeff.
Well, it's possible that, the Apostle Paul gives an explanation for that when he's talking about an example from marriage, when he's saying that, you know, something is in force only as long as one is living. And then when the person dies, they're discharged from it.
Right.
So, if that were the case with all these promises, once Abraham died, oop, promise over. So, in a sense, that seed that he was talking about with Abraham is who the promise was in. When Abraham died, he became a part of that seed, and that promise kept going from generation to generation, and everybody's just tagging on to that seed. The seed is still alive, and the seed is still going.
That is true, and that's where we get Messiah from, is through that seed. That's the point of it. Abraham didn't get to see that himself. I mean, yes, obviously he saw Isaac be born, but he didn't get to see what happened. He didn't get to, he had to believe through faith that this would continue on. We went up to the mountain ready to kill his son, that somehow this is going to continue on. He had to believe through that. So yes, he believed it completely. And yes, he had to hang his hat on that belief when he was dying on his deathbed and how many sons he has, I forgot the number, later on. So yes, absolutely, that's where the promise went through, and that's where the promise was going to be fulfilled. And everyone before that Messiah shows up has to hang their hat on the same promise. But to actually get to see it is also important too. It's part of it. To just hang your hat on the faith, it will happen, and then that's it. No offense, but that takes the whole purpose out of things, where you never actually get to see it happen, never get to experience what's going on. You just have to say, oh, well, I just get to throw my little hat on there that it will happen one day and I'm done now. I'm forever gone. Nothing will ever happen again. There's no enjoyment there. There's no hope there. It's just somewhere off in the distance. So I think that's one of the reasons why Messiah was pointing out that these men will get to see what this looks like. Yeah, even Moses got to see it with the Spirit. Yes, go ahead.
But the fact that they heard the voice of God.
Yes.
That would be like, okay. Okay.
That's true. Admittedly, hearing the voice of God, I'm sure, would be enough to make you believe there's something seriously going on here that to follow and obey. But Abraham followed from his friendship with that voice. And Isaac obeyed because of his fear of that voice. And Jacob, well, he kind of did a little bit of both. a little mixture of friendship and fear and trusting of that voice. It's the voice they believed or trusted. And they had, that was their seed, as Jeff pointed. That was their hanging their hat on their beliefs. It was based on what that voice had told them. And they would continue on, which is a beautiful thing. It's important for us. We needed that. I'm sure it would terrify the daylights out of me, as I'm sure most of you, if God starts to talk to you in voices. But anyway, my opinion is that's where this promise, this demonstration from Moses that he was the way of resurrection, where it's leading to or from. Okay, I got a few minutes left, so I'm going to jump a little bit. Well, there's one thing I have to cover first. I'll jump ahead and cover something else, which is related to this. One detail, verse, where is it? I will not go through three signs, the snake and the hand and the blood thing today. We'll do it some other time. It's not super critical. Circumcision. Moses, actually, well, I guess his son, gets circumcised regarding this when he's experiencing this event in verse 24 and through 26. This is on this lodging or someplace they're staying along the way. The Lord encountered him. We've talked this before, who the him is, and sought to kill the him. It doesn't specify who the him is in this story, but it is interpreted to mean a particular person, but it wasn't what it appeared at first. So the Lord took a sharp stone, cut off the foreskin of her son. Now, says my friend says, it touched it to his feet and said, you caused my bridegroom's bloodshed. So she released him. So he released him. Then she said, a bridegroom's bloodshed was because of circumcision. That's my translation reads that. Yours, I'm sure, reads something slightly different. I'm not going to go into what translation says what. The purpose I want to bring out to you, which is, I wrote up here while during the break system, break time. I have the circumcision and the baptism of Messiah tied together on purpose. I did that because I wanted to. The circumcision of Moses' son, Gershom, and now Moses has at least two sons. He may have more now, I don't remember. He has at least two sons. Gershom's one of them. My translation says, of course, the him being the one who is dying or being held by the Lord is Moses. Moses is the one that God's about to kill. And to save Moses' life, Zipporah's got to whack off a chunk of her son, Gershom, to save his life. How she made the connection, I can't tell you. Who revealed it to you that was the reason or purpose? I don't know. Why was it important to be done? God said, did say to do that. Was it Luke? Where is it? Wrong chapter. Hold on. Oh, Matthew 3. Matthew chapter 3. Jump through real quick. There is a, for lack of a better term, in my mind, a requirement for all people who are going to do God's bidding. You have to obey God. Now, it may not say in every way, in every aspect of your life, but whatever instruction you go do, you have to go obey the instruction. That's my opinion. In Matthew chapter 3, we'll go back in chapter 2 in a few minutes. We'll be going to chapter 2 in a few minutes, but not yet. Jonah, verse 13. The Messiah came from Galilee to John, the Jordan, to be baptized by him. And John tried to prevent him, saying, I have need to be baptized by you, and are you coming to me? The Messiah answered and said to him, permit it to be so for now, for thus it is fitting for us to fulfill all righteousness. Then he allowed him. Jesus, when he went to be baptized, he came up immediately in the water, and behold, the heavens were opened to him, and he saw the Spirit of the God descending like a dove alighting upon him. So the voice came from heaven, saying, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased. I tie circumcision and baptism together on purpose. Because to me, they are virtually the same thing. Why would I say that? John says so, but in different words. Same in chapter 3, go earlier on, verse 1. In those days, John the Baptist came, preached the wilderness of Judea, saying, repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand. For this is he who was spoken of by prophet Isaiah, saying, the voice of one crying in the wilderness, prepare the way of the Lord, make his paths straight. And John himself was clothed in camel's hair, with leather belt around his waist, and smooth locust wild honey. Jerusalem, all Judea, and all the region around Jordan went out to him and were baptized by him in the Jordan, confessing their sins. Now, what I want to draw your attention to is the word repent. What does the word repent mean? Turn around and go back. What is circumcision? Rolling away your reproach. That's what it is. That's what the Bible tells us. Circumcision is the rolling away of the reproach of God against you for whatever you've been doing or are like or are likened unto. So, to roll away your reproach means God no longer reproaches you, right? To repent means you're now going to go follow God and reverse what you've been doing. They're the same symbol. They mean the same thing. To repent or to roll away God's reproach is the same purpose, the same function. They do the same thing. They mark you. And you're going to flip around and go where you belong, where God wants you to go. So it's the same distance, the same process. You're going to take what you are and roll away what isn't good and go back to what is good. It's the same symbol. So, to me, circumcision and baptism are tied together very, very closely, because baptism comes from repentance, right? It's repent first, and you baptize. That's how the process is supposed to work. So roll away reproach, you get circumcised. That's how it's supposed to work. So to me, they're tied together on purpose. So John the Baptist is rolling away people's reproach, as God had commanded all the people of Israel to roll away their reproach. By John the Baptist telling people repent, and people of Israel get yourself cut. Same idea. It's the same principle. To circumcise your heart. Remember that concept? To soften it to what God wants. Remold what God wants. It. What's repentance? The same thing. Yes, James. Question. Go ahead.
Was there baptism before John the Baptist? Or how did they just know that this was baptism?
Yes, there was baptism before John the Baptist. Yes. I cannot tell you the year it began. I don't know. But Solomon had baptisms inside of the temple he built. The big baptismal baths that they would go through and cleanse you each month or each week or however often. The priests had to bathe themselves from Aaron's time onward on a regular basis after individual things before and following certain events. So baptism was a common thing. Now, we think of baptism once in your life. Well, okay, yeah, that's not a very accurate way of doing things. No offense to anyone in the room, but after baptism, I've made mistakes. I know, it's a shock, isn't it? I made mistakes too. So, and what's the point? Well, the same point of repentance. Go back, turn around, cleanse yourself, start again, clean yourself up. It's the same thing. So, in the priesthood, God designed baptism as a regular event. No, anybody who offered something or was unclean. So it's just Levites. You could be unclean from anything. Unclean from an action, like you did something awful, or you touched some dead body, or you did, whatever the reason is, you had to clean yourself to restart again. Lots of reasons for baptism. And, of course, women commonly did baptism every month for the cycle. So it wasn't called the term baptism as we use the term baptism. But it's the same thing, the same process of wash away the junk, go back and restart again. Yes, Cheryl.
A quick question, and this is more because of what your mom, Ellie, taught us, or taught me, is that it has to be in living water. She told me that living water means the water has to be overflowing. It's a little hard to overflow your bathtub. So
really? I won't... she's not finished. Go ahead.
Can living water just be water flowing into the bathtub, or?
Well, okay, to be fair, this is I have no argument with my parents on any of the issues, so I don't discuss arguments with my parents on purpose. It's not my place to ever do so. So, to me, the Jordan River isn't always overflooding. It's flowing, but it's not always overflooding, not always going over its bank. No, it does sometimes, but not always, not all the time. Right. Many rivers do not overflow all the time. Some do, some don't. So the overflowing part isn't necessarily a requirement per se. Moving water is what the point is. Now, in all the baptisms, in the temple in particular, all the water citations, all examples, the only, I guess you can use the word bath, no one was allowed to get into. It was a really big bath. It held a whole lot of water. It had bowls under it, and it was big color, copper brass. It was brass bowl. It held water, but no one got to go in it. They pulled water out of it and poured it on people to flow water over them, to cleanse them or wash utensils, whatever it was that was used for. And the temple also had cut into it on, I think it was mostly underneath. I don't think it was inside the temple itself, it was underneath it. Like little bathtubs, essentially. But water could flow in and flow out. It's a flowing process, which is what they did. Now, John the Baptist was using the river, which is fine. It's a flowing process to flow. Because to wash away sins or wash away your reproach is to get rid of it, not to sit in it. Okay? You know, sit in a bathtub of your muck. This is supposed to make me cleaner? Not usually. The concept of belief is to wash it away, which is flowing water. I'm not going to argue anything beyond whether your bathtub can handle overflowing or not, or whether you should just pull a drain plug and have the water run at the same time. That's your decision, not mine. I can't say what you should or shouldn't do. I'm just saying that that's what it was physically built as for practical reasons. Who wants to go in and clean out the muck from a used bathtub? Now, we have drains. We pull the drain plug. What if there isn't a drain? Get a bucket. Start bucketing it out. Not so pleasant. So, and you also have germs, diseases grow. So baths is where supposed to be for flowing process, to flow out, to flow in and flow out. However that happens, your business. That's just how it happened. Okay. Let's continue on because I want to go past this. I have only 3 minutes left.
3 minutes.
Woo! All right, I do this. Up here I have my little chart. Now, this is not exhaustive. This is just a general idea concept. We get the idea of what's going on here. We've heard this story before with Moses and the baskets and the Pharaoh and all the stuff. Not because we've read it before, well, that is true too, but because it's repeated again. Now, Messiah goes the same process. Not identical, but very similar. Symbols are the same. So, King of Egypt is also known as Pharaoh the First, one who decreed, let's kill all the babies. Recall Messiah ran the two with Herod. I believe he was number one. There were only two Herods, right? One and two. There wasn't a one, two, and three. I don't remember. There's just one and two. There's just one and two. So Herod the First, he had the same problem with Messiah being born. Remember that story? The wise men come, saw the star. He said, okay, how old was the star? This is recorded in Matthew chapter 2. The star was umpteen, however many months old, and he killed everybody in Bethlehem and the surrounding areas that were 2 months or, 2 years or younger. Then, of course, the night before, the wise men go to Messiah to say their whatever prayers and blessings and give gifts and yada, yada, yada. In Matthew 2, it's recorded, verse 13. Behold, they departed before the wise men. And behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise, take the young child and his mother to flee to Egypt and stay there until I bring word to you. For Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. When he arose, took the young child with his mother by night and departed for Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, out of Egypt I called my son. I like Hosea 11. That's great. He records that in Hosea. So Pharaoh has a similar decree that Herod did. Now, Pharaoh's fear was the overpowering of the Israelites and fleeing the land, right? Overpowering him and fleeing the land. What's Herod afraid of? The Messiah overpowering his throne and ruling. Logical thing. They're afraid of the same thing. They have the same solution. Let's kill somebody. Let's kill it. Don't kill what you're afraid of, right? That's the golden rule, right? So Pharaoh the First and Herod the First, essentially, I'm sorry, Pharaoh the First. The first Pharaoh that we're dealing with in Moses, I shouldn't say the Pharaoh the First, that's not a name. The first Pharaoh we're dealing with Moses in King Herod the First had the same solution, the same problem, or a similar problem. You note that in the time of Pharaoh, Egypt was a place of sin and transgression and evil stuff, the oppressive, you know, being mean, you know, they'll crack the whips. In the time of Herod, what was Judea like? Same thing. Just different. The same thing, but it's different. The rulership was treating people just as rotten. Now, they were not building bricks. They weren't doing the straw and the stubble. They were still treating the people horribly and oppressing them. It's the same idea. So, Egypt and Judea were the same. Just different oriented, different ways of doing things. Now, in Pharaoh and Moses' time, the solution for Moses was to hide him in a basket to save him. Now, the solution for Messiah was what? Send him to Egypt for the solution, to hide him in Egypt for a period of time. Now, Moses, of course, survives this basket experience and the killing of the children, and he survives, he comes out of it alive, and of course, the first Pharaoh, if he's the same one I think he is, dies shortly after he made the decree. Herod the First, guess what? Same fate. He gets whacked too. God whacks him a couple years after the event too. So they both die the same way. Now I have wrote here the second Pharaoh because I do not know for certain whether the Pharaoh is the same guy or is a new one. I don't know when Moses killed the Egyptian. I can't swear it's a different Pharaoh. I don't know for certain, but it probably is. The second Pharaoh sought to kill Moses. In particular, remember that event? He actually seeks out Moses because Moses killed the Egyptian. Well, this Herod was seeking out a particular individual. And not only that, his son tried to do the same thing. Not Herod II, the other son. He had an intermediate son there. I forgot the guy's name. That's an A. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, spell it. Say it again. It's R something, whatever. R, I'll just abbreviate. His son is the one immediately survives, and it's recorded. Let's see, where is it? It's recorded in also in 2 Matthew. Yeah, there it is, in verse 23. When he heard that Archelaus, whatever, was reigning over Judea instead of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there, and being warned by God in a dream, he turned aside and returned to the region of Galilee. So even this guy is not trustworthy either, also desiring to kill the Messiah if he had the opportunity. You will also run across Pharaoh number 3, the one that I have labeled number 3, the one that Moses goes back and says, let my people go. I have him linked to Pharaoh number 2, in my opinion. Now, I have linked to Pharaoh number 2 for one particular reason. Pharaoh number 3 said something to Moses. He said, I don't know this Lord of yours. I'm not going to let him go free. Let Israel go free. Herod number 2, he was supposed to know God, supposedly, was supposed to be a believer in God. He was supposed to do what God told him to do. But what did he do? Who did he kill? John the Baptist in particular. Herod number 1 killed the children. Herod number 2 killed John the Baptist, beheaded him. I won't say at a whim per se, but almost at a whim. He didn't want to, but he did anyway. Did he fear God? Not even close. He feared his wife. And feared, as it was recorded in the death. I believe it's recorded in, where was it recorded? I forgot where it's recorded. I don't think I wrote it down. Anyway, it's recorded when he kills it. I think it's in Matthew 2. I could be wrong. When he kills it, he's recorded that it's Herodias and... Herodias was a daughter. Salome, thank you, Salome. Thank you, Herodias and Salome. The Salome's dance, and Herod II says, up to half my kingdom I'll give to you. Should sound familiar with those of you who are familiar with Esther. I'll give to whatever you ask for, and she says, hey, Mom, what do you want? John the Baptist said, all right, give me a head. So he gives it a head. And Herod's reason, though he thought it was wrong, was because he was afraid of what the people around him would think. So was he fearful of God? No. Did he even know God then? Apparently not. So to me, this Herod number 2 and Pharaoh, the third Pharaoh that Moses deals with, essentially are the same type of person. Because Pharaoh number 3, which Death will have a fun time with all the plagues, he gets his heart hardened again and again and again and again. Even his own advisors say, are you crazy? Stop this. Can't you see that Egypt is lost? So, but he still refuses. It's the appearance. He's very big on what it appears for Pharaoh number 3, just as Herod number 2 was big on what it appeared. It's important, more important than what was right. So, that's my symbolism, which I rattle off to you. And of course, angel speaks to Joseph and Miriam. And of course, obviously, God speaks to Moses in the communication of going back and forth. So, the story of Moses, though it's not complete, is similar to the story of Messiah, though I didn't cover all of it. I didn't cover every exhaustive detail. This is just a general idea of what the symbols are. I'm going to not cover the balance of all I was going to rattle off today, which had to do with the firstborn and why Israel's the firstborn at this moment in time in God's eyes, while Ephraim does. You know, I won't cover this year. I won't cover this till probably another year from now, but I might cover it next time because we're going to cover it a year, or maybe Jeff will. Who knows? I don't know if it comes up again. I don't recall. But there's a firstborn detail as far as when a firstborn is and when a firstborn isn't, because it goes back and forth and back and forth. You think firstborn is the one who's literally born first. Not even close. That's almost never the case. The firstborn is almost always never born first.
I think you're rattling.
Rattling, something moving around, something, I don't know. The firstborn is usually the one who God chooses. It's almost always the one who God chooses. And it changes. God even changes his opinion. He's firstborn now in this circumstance. Later on, he's not. He actually gets a switch. So we'll discuss that probably some other time with how God manipulates what firstborn means. Much like he uses his own name, it's a title, it's a position. It means something at that moment in time while he's using it, then it changes later. Any questions or comments? I'm calling it quits for the day. Hopefully this is fun. I enjoyed Exodus, the first couple chapters there. I didn't cover every detail, but general idea. Most of the information is written on, or sorry, recorded online for you to look at or observe yourself to read. Thank you for your time. Have a good rest of your Shabbat.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.